about Fly Fishing Internet Radio, your source for learning more about fly fishing in cold water, warm water, and salt water. Hello, I'm Roger Maves, your host for tonight's show. On this broadcast, we'll be featuring Alan McGee, and he'll be answering your most important questions on fly fishing soft tackles. This show will be 90 minutes in length, and we're broadcasting live over the Internet. If you'd like to ask Alan a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box there to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. And while you're there, make sure you sign up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Just fill in your name and your email address in the form on our homepage, and we'll keep you informed. This broadcast is being recorded and will be available for playback on our website within about 48 hours after the show ends. So if you have to leave early, you can return to our website at your convenience and listen to the broadcast at any time. The content of this broadcast is copyrighted and is the property of the Knowledge Group, Inc., doing business as Ask About Fly Fishing. Recordings or transcriptions of this program cannot be distributed or sold in any form. When we return, we'll be talking with Alan McGee about fly fishing soft tackles. Looking for that shot at a permit? Whipray Key Fishing Lodge in Belize is where you want to be. When you stay at Whipray Key Fishing Lodge, you're on a private island, and you're only minutes away from some of the finest permit fishing in Belize. Whipray Key is just a 30-minute boat ride from Placentia. Once you're there, you'll be fishing Permit Alley, one of Belize's best fisheries, and you won't be taking long boat rides to get started. You'll fish with world-class guides like Daniel Cabral, whose family has fished the area for over 30 years. Want to switch it up and fish for tarpon and bonefish and make it a grand slam? They can make it happen at Whipray Key Fishing Lodge. Book your next adventure now. Visit WhiprayKeyFishingLodge.com. That's Whipray, and then C-A-Y-E, FishingLodge.com. Before we introduce Alan, we'd like to let you know about the great gifts we have to give away tonight. For our drawing tonight, we'll be giving away a one-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers and a one-year subscription to the Fly Fishing and Tying Journal. So you have two chances to win tonight in our drawing. Now, if you haven't registered yet for the drawing, you can do so now. Just go to our homepage, which is askaboutflyfishing.com, and look for the link under Alan's section that says, click here to register for our drawing. Click on that link and fill out the form, and we'll announce the winners at the end of the show. We'll also be giving away a copy of Alan's book, Fly Fishing Soft Tackles, courtesy of Stackpole Books. And to find out more about the great books that Stackpole has for fly fishing, go to stackpolebooks.com, stackpolebooks.com. So here's how you can win. You must be the first person to answer the question we ask at the end of the show. The question is going to be about something we talk about during the show, and you must submit your answer along with your name and location in the text box on our homepage. So listen closely and use your best typing skills, and maybe you'll win Alan's book. Our guest tonight is Alan McGee. Alan has been a trout fly fisherman for nearly 25 years. He specializes in both traditional and progressive soft tackle flies and their fishing methods. Alan is an author, fly designer, photographer, and nationwide trout angler. He is mainly interested in innovative soft tackle fly patterns incorporating traditional and modern materials into modern soft tackle flies, sometimes using new tying methods designed for species-specific presentation methods that stimulate the natural's behavior, action, and movement. He has designed flies for the Montana Fly Company and is now designing flies for Solitude Fly Company and is a member of the Regal Vice Pro staff. He is also a founding member of the International Brother of the Flint. Alan wants to push what soft tackle flies are thought of being used for and how they are fished. He believes that soft tackle features can be incorporated into all life stages of insects and other food items in the trout's diet. He is the author of Tying and Fishing Soft Tackle Nymphs, Spiders, and Flimps, The Evolution of the Soft Tackle Fly and Fly Fishing Soft Tackles, Nymphs, Emergers, and Dry Flies, and is currently working on a new book. His articles and photography have appeared in many popular fly fishing magazines. Alan lives in Atlanta, Georgia. His local waters include the mountain streams and tailwaters in North Georgia, North Carolina, and Tennessee. Alan also fishes regularly in the Rocky Mountain West, Midwest, and throughout the East Coast streams. Alan, welcome to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio.
Thanks, Roger. It's good to be here.
Well, good to have you. And, boy, never thought soft tackle would be such a popular topic, but we got a load of questions in tonight. So, be prepared, everyone. We're going to move fast and furiously, and Alan's going to do his best to try to to get through all these, but it is going to be a challenge for sure. You know, at times we have, you know, balance issues with the audio and so forth. I'm sensitive to that. If during the show you think that Alan or I need our volume pushed up, just type it in that text box and on the homepage, and I'll note it and try to make that a bit better for you out there. So just with that out of the way, let's get started, Alan. First, can you talk a little bit about the history of soft tackle flies and, you know, their journey to where they are in today's world? Because it seems like it's taken quite a journey.
Oh, yeah. I mean, according to literature, they're probably the oldest flies in existence, and they weren't called soft tackles until Sylvester Neans kind of coined the term soft tackle in the 1970s. They were just called wet flies, wingless wet flies before that. They date back actually to, well, in Ernest Schweibert's book, Trout, he says that they're more than 2,300 years old, and they date back to China. Now, the first recording I've found of them really is in a 1496 book called The Book of St. Albans, which Dame Julianne Berner wrote, and she mentioned a fly called the Don fly, which many people think is the partridge in orange of today. So 1496, you know, or older. So that's where we start with this.
Wow.
So there's
wow.
a long history there. And, you know, don't have time to go through the whole history of it tonight, but, you know, there's a lot out there to read on the starting with the North Country spiders in England, and the, you know, the border between Scotland and England is kind of where the North Country spiders came from, that region. And that was back in the 1800s. The Americans, well, then you had G.E.M. Skews who fished in southern England. And in southern England, the streams were all chalk streams, and it was dry fly only, upstream presentation, and wet flies were frowned upon, okay? You weren't supposed to fish your fly underwater. But Skews knew that, you know, trout were feeding primarily underwater. 90% of the time they feed underwater. So, you know, he started fishing nymphs, and there was a big debate about if he was allowed to do that. But anyway, you know, we came through that, and nymphs are where they are today. But, you know, then you have the American school starting in the 1930s with, like, Ray Bergman's trout, which he talks about a lot of winged wet flies. Then we go into Leisingering and Heidi, who kind of developed the wingless wet fly, not developed it, but they documented it, I should say, and worked on evolution of it and all. And that was in the 1940s. And then in 1971, an interesting fact actually is the book The Art of the Wet Fly was printed in 1941, right as the war was starting, you know. And so it was sort of an overlooked book because of the World War II. But anyway, they reprinted the book in the 1970. In 1971, they reprinted it and they added a new chapter about the flimp, which Pete Heidi coined the term of a transitional wet fly called a flimp, which is basically an emerger, you know. Half of it's the fly, half of it's the nymph, the emerging nymph, called the flimp. Anyway, so that was in 1971, and then in, like, 1975, you had Sylvester Neans with his book starting in 1975, and he, you know, really reintroduced wet flies, and again, he coined the term soft tackle. And then he did that throughout the 1980s. But they've always been evolving, you know, up until even modern wet flies of today. And so, you know, you had anglers like Charlie Brooks, who a lot of people don't think of him for wet flies, but a lot of his nymphs have soft tackle collars and a lot of movement designed into the fly to attract the fish. You had Jack Gartside, who had flies like the Gartside Sparrow and his Gold Bug nymph, which both incorporate elements of soft tackles in them. And, you know, and then you have kind of what I'm doing today, which is more modern wet flies, modern soft tackles, which kind of match all life stages and all species of important trout insects in North America. So I use wet flies to imitate. All my flies have a soft tackle collar in one way or another built into them, even if it's a nymph, an emerger, an adult, or a spinner. Terrestrials, bait fish, scuds, you know, damselfly nymphs, everything.
Wow.
So I kind of like to incorporate it in there too, you know, because not just because of the movement of the way you fish it, it's all kind of incorporated together. So my fly tying design and my fishing methods complement each other. And when I'm actually designing a fly or tying a fly, I know in my mind's eye how I'm going to be fishing it. So it's kind of like as I'm tying the fly, I'm building fly to the method I'm going to use to fish it. You know what I mean?
Good, good. Well, hopefully we can get into that a little bit deeper here tonight as we go forward. Let's start out with a question from Andrew Gramp. Now, I think, Andrew, I hope you're listening, Andrew, in Pennsylvania might be pretty late for a 9-year-old. But anyway, you can listen to the recording if you're not listening tonight. But this has got to be the question from the youngest fly fisher that I've ever had on the show, so I find it very interesting. And talking about very well written, here we go. Hi, Alan. I saw you at the fly fishing show earlier this year. I love your book that I got there. My question is, where did you get the idea to use soft tackles for flies other than the so-called traditional soft tackles? I mean wet flies, commonly called soft tackles like partridge and orange. What gave you the idea to use soft tackles and other styles of flies such as emergers, dries, and stuff not typical of what we think of when we hear soft tackles? And then next, can you elaborate on the types of flies that use soft tackles? It was so cool meeting you and talking with you at the show. I have your autograph on my bedroom door so I can see it every day. Thanks so much, Andrew Gramp, age 9, from Pottstown, Pennsylvania. So,
yeah, I remember Andrew. I remember meeting him. I remember him. How you doing? Yeah. He came up to me and he had his Cub Scout uniform on.
and
he said, and he handed me a card to sign, and that's the card he's got on his door, I guess. I don't know. That's great.
Yeah, that's cool.
So, it is cool. So, Andrew, so basically, you know, I fished soft tackles just as like everybody else did, just basically the emerger, the unweighted standard soft tackles in the beginning. But I also started putting them into nymphs more and fishing them deeper, and I found that even the movement at all levels was great. So, you know, it just led me to say, well, why can't I just put it in all the life stages, all the life cycles of each species of caddis and midge and mayfly and stonefly, and just incorporate it into everything. And so that's what I've been doing, you know, and that's what I do. Even terrestrials, like wet ants, you know, I put a soft tackle collar on them and fish them wet instead of a dry ant, you know. You know, trout, like as you said, you know, Skews found, you know, he said, you know, they feed underwater primarily. So subsurface patterns are, you can fish them at all levels. Soft tackles, you can fish them at all levels, even as adults and spinners. And basically, though, you know, I use different feathers. For instance, I'll use a partridge feather, which has a little more bulkiness to it, for like a caddis pupa, because caddis are good swimmers, so you want to have a lot of action in the fly. But a fly like, you know, mayfly spinner is a very, you know, delicate fly. And so I would just use like one or two turns of hen cape with just a very subtle soft tackle collar on it. But, you know, I fish that dead drift as a spinner, but the legs will move and pulsate just slightly in the current. And even though it's dead, you know, a spent spinner is dead, its legs will still slightly move around in the current. So that's kind of, you know, I build the soft tackle to the life cycle I'm trying to imitate. And, again, like I'll imitate mayflies with soft-tackled nymphs and flints and then soft-tackled dry wet flies that I can fish the dun. I can fish it like a dead drift on the first half of the presentation. And then I can pull it underwater and fish it wet like an emerger. Mm-hmm. So it gives you two presentations in one on my soft-tackled dry flies. And I'll do the same thing on the soft-tackled spinners. I'll fish that dead drift in the first half of the presentation. Then I'll pull it underwater and give it a bend or two because you want it to dead drift underwater. You don't want it to swing or anything because a sunken spinner, a lot of people don't think about that. You know, eventually spinners will sink if they're not eaten. And so trout see a lot of sunken spinners, but it gives you that ability to fish it first half of your presentation dry, you know, like a dead drift spinner, and then you pull it underwater and give it a mend to give yourself dead drift float underwater, subsurface drift.
Yeah, so, I think that's...
And then, you know, I'll do that... Yeah.
I think that pretty much answers Chuck Cadman's question from Santa Rosa, California. He says, you have to use soft tackles as emergers or spent insects. So you just kind of went through that whole scenario of how you how you do that, right?
That's for mayflies, you know. And then with caddis, I'd imitate larvae with a soft tackle collar, and the pupa obviously is a swimmer, and it's a good swimmer. And so there'll be a lot of action when I fish caddis pupa with soft tackles. And then again with the caddis adult, I'll fish it dead drift and then pull it underwater like a emerging pupa, or it could imitate the diving egg layer, because a lot of caddis events, you know, the egg laying and the emergence overlap, and so some will be emerging and some will be diving underwater to lay eggs in the evenings especially, right? And so you can imitate both life stages with one fly and in one presentation as well.
Yeah. Rick Takahashi, who is a noted guest on our show, wrote a book on midges, and that was quite good.
Yep.
Rick asks, he says, I'm really looking forward to the podcast. Can you please recommend hooks best suited for soft tackle and materials most useful in tying these patterns? So do you use a particular kind of hook that you wouldn't otherwise?
Yeah. Well, it's all about, like, what I like to call behavior, action, and movement. So the behavior, when I'm designing a fly, I'm thinking, you know, what kind of behavior does this mayfly species have? Is it a drifting mayfly on emergence, or does it emerge underwater, or does it crawl to the surface to emerge? So I think about that when I design the fly, and then the action of the materials I use that make it come alive, you know, and then the movement is how I'm going to fish it. Is it, you know, like a natural rising or falling, like some PMD and selvers make practice runs, so they're kind of coming up and down like a jigging action to the fly. Diving egg layers crawl underwater, so you're going to want a, you know, sunken subsurface fly. But those are all the behavior, action, and movement are how I design a fly. And that goes to the hooks. That goes to their appearance. So a lot of my hooks, sometimes if I can't find a hook that I like to use that has the shape I want, I bend hooks, okay, to the shape for like a swimming nymph, like a swimming mayfly nymph. I'll take a straight hook like a Tamco 3761, and I'll slightly bend up the front of it to give it kind of a curvature to it, you know, and give it that swimming, because that's how mayfly nymphs swim with their abdomen, kind of like a dolphin kick. So, you know, their thorax is higher or lower than their abdomen at certain times as they're swimming. And so, in other words, back to the hooks, though, themselves. There's certain hooks I like, but again, it's kind of the shape and weight I think about. So for, like, mayfly nymphs, I like the Tiemco 3761s. I also like the Mustad S82s, which are straight-shank hooks. They're the same as the 3906Bs that they used to make. Eagle Claw actually makes a hook called the L063, which is a straight shank nymph hook, and you can bend that one easily because it's not as tempered as the Tiemcos and the Mustads. So those other ones, sometimes you'll bend them and they'll just break because they're so highly tempered. But these Eagle Claw hooks you can bend and they'll keep their shape, and I can get different appearances to my nymphs, like swimming nymphs or straight nymphs, things like that. For caddis, I like, you know, the scud hooks like the Tiemco 2457 or 2488s. The Tiemco 206BL is kind of a cool-shaped caddis pupa hook. It's a curved hook, but then it kind of straightens out, and then it kind of rises up again at the eye, kind of like a upturned eye. The Mustad C49S is a nice caddis hook also. It's a bent hook. And so again,
Your hooks, Alan.
You can see, yeah. But you can see the shape I'm talking about there. So the mayfly straight hooks, right, or slightly bent, but the caddis, you know, curved hooks. So that's kind of how I think about the shape there. And same with stonefly nymphs. I'll take like a Mustad 79 5ED, which is, you know, like a 3XL long streamer hook for a stonefly nymph. And I'll bend up the front of that, too, just like I do with the mayfly nymph, and give it a swimming nymph appearance to it.
Yeah.
So, and then for dry flies, just like the Tiemco 100s, just, you know, fine wire, just simple hook for dry flies,
yeah.
You know.
Kenny Climes in St. Louis writes, Alan, when tying soft tackles, what kind of hackle do you use for your flies, and which is your favorite?
Oh, boy. I could go on about this for a while. Well, feathers, it's all about feathers, really. It really is. I mean, that's what soft tackles are, aren't they? So, and, you know, the bodies themselves and bodies are important. But I have, you know, in my room right here, I have hundreds and hundreds of feathers and all organized differently. But I'll tell you some of my favorite ones. The partridge, obviously everybody uses partridge, Hungarian partridge, and it's still probably my favorite because of the amount of different colors you can get. You know, everything from the browns on the back to the grays on the upper, on the back of the neck to the marginal covert feathers on the elbow of the wings, which are kind of a mottled brown. But there's so many different, and then even like under on the belly, there's kind of yellow lemon yellow feathers on the partridge. They're nice for like sulfur soft tackles and kind of imitate the orangish yellow of those colors. So partridge is always a good, you can never have enough of that. And I'll give you a little hint on, if you want to tie small flies with partridge, you know, you can use the smaller gray feathers up near the back of the neck, and they're gray. But if you want to make them brown, because the brown feathers are usually harder to find in smaller sizes on partridge. But if you want to make them brown, you just use a Prismacolor marker and just take a single feather off, put it on a piece of notebook paper, and run that marker over the top of it and just a couple times, and you got a brown partridge feather in small size right there.
Right.
So that's a good way to do that. You know, grouse are good feathers. They're softer than partridge, but the problem with them, they're kind of big, but you can use compensated methods to make tie smaller flies with them, which I talk about in my book, how to use large feathers to tie small flies. A nice feather that I like also is the Brahma hen saddle. And in the mottled gray is a good color. It simulates gray partridge if you want to substitute it for that. But the cool thing about the Brahma hen is the fibers at the tip are very small. So if you tie it in, you know, you tie in your hackle by the tip, you can make just a turn or two turns and tie down to like a size 18 with those. They look like they're large feathers, but the tip fibers are very short. So they'll tie really small flies with the Brahma hen saddle. And you can also use a marker on those if you want to change the color of the feather on like the gray one, on the mottled gray Brahma hen. Mm-hmm. You can use a marker on that. Okay, I'll talk about hen capes for a second. So a lot of people are familiar with like the whiting hen capes. In the red or the 4B, they also make one called the 4B. And I like the hen capes for like my soft tackle dry flies. The fibers are a little stiffer and it gives a little bit better floatability. Not as stiff as dry fly hackle, but not as soft as India hen necks, which are non-genetic. And the India hen necks feathers are softer than the genetic hen capes are. And they're also a little bit cheaper, but they're not as commonly found, but they're called India hen necks. And if you find those, it's good to buy a number. If I find a stock, I'll buy like five or six of them just so I'll have a good supply.
Yeah.
I also like marabou and chickaboo, which a lot of people don't think of as soft hackle feathers, but you can use them for, and they're the softest there is. They're softer than anything. But you can use them for soft tackles by like tying them forward off the front of the hook, you know, and then you go back and you build your body. You kind of distribute it around off on the front. You go back and build the body, then you come up back to the front and you jump in front of it and sweep all the fibers back, make a thread dam, and it's got a soft hackle collar on it with marabou and chickaboo, which is very soft.
We have a question that came in on the internet that Bob Lewis in Oxford, he says, how do you judge the hackle length when you're tying soft hackle flies?
Well, you know, it depends on how you want the fly to look like. Do you want it to have a hackle collar that's longer than the hook shank, which, you know, if you look at some caddis flies, like a diving caddis, the wing is going to be longer than the body, so you're going to want a long hackle on it. If you want a like a soft-hackled nymph, you'd tie a short hackle where the hackle would only come back to perhaps the hook point because the legs on the may, you're simulating the hook, the legs on the mayfly nymph. If you want, and then the standard answer to that is the hackle collar should come back to the where the hook bend starts and goes, you know, where the hook bend, where the bend starts, the shank ends and the bend starts. So I use different lengths to imitate different species or, you know, mayflies and caddis, things like that. How you judge it is, you know, you just pick a feather. You don't have to pluck it off, but you look at what part of the feather you're going to wrap and just see how long those fibers are. The shorter fibers are going to be found at the tip of the feather. So that's why I use a lot of tip tie in when I hackle my flies. I'll get just the very tip fibers and try to get the shortest fibers I can get on it. And then as I continue to wrap the feather, you know, they'll get larger and larger and larger until, you know, so that's how you can size it like that.
Sure, and you don't need a ton of hackle on there like you do for a dry fly necessarily, right? I mean, you're...
No. I kind of hackle my flies depending on, again, the species. Mayflies, you know, mayflies, nymphs would have less than perhaps a diving caddis, all right? Because, you know, you can see, you know, the species kind of you're imitating kind of has different appearances. And mayflies are kind of more fragile looking than caddis, you know what I mean? Another thing I do is, depending on the water type I'm fishing, if it's a spring creek, real flat water, spooky fish, yeah, I'll tie a sparser fly. But if it's like the Madison River at dusk, you know, I'll probably want more action built into my fly to grab the attention of the fish.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's water, species type, and time of day and time of year. All those factors go in actually to how much I hackle the fly.
Alan, we need to take a quick break, and we'll be right back so we can dig into this a bit more. Watermaster is dedicated to providing their customers with the highest quality inflatables on the market, as well as unbeatable customer service and product support. They are best known for their signature products, the Watermaster Grizzly and Kodiak rafts. These rafts are lightweight, compact, durable, versatile, and safe. The Watermaster rafts are everything your personal watercraft should be. They have been used by anglers and hunters all over the world for over 15 years, including Dave Whitlock, one of fly fishing's greatest innovators. Dave said, "With my Watermaster, I can enjoy more fishing per hour than any other method I've ever tried. After 2.5 years of testing 15 models of kickboats, I'm convinced that the Watermaster is the ultimate personal flotation craft for warm and cold water fly fishing." Visit Watermaster today and take a look at the ultimate personal flotation craft. Go to BigSkyInflatables.com. That's BigSkyInflatables.com. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, and we're talking with Alan McGee about fly fishing soft tackles. If you'd like to ask Alan a question, just go to our homepage at AskAboutFlyFishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately. We'll try to answer them as we receive them on the show tonight. So, Alan, I always ask my guests, you know, what's going on in your fly fishing world? Got any new projects going?
My book came out, my last book came out in November, and, you know, I'm always working on something, whether it's just taking notes on my fishing days on the water or making new flies up. I just got back from Federation of Fly Fishers Fair out in Livingston, Montana about a week ago, and that was a lot of fun. I got to fish a lot, you know, before and after it. But, you know, the Madison and the Henry's Fork, and I fished on the Pews Spring Creek, which I try to do whenever I go out to Livingston. And, you know, now I'm just back in Alpharetta, Georgia, and trying to fish as much as I can here, you know, till the next trip.
Do you have, Alan, do you have a website or anything where people can learn more about you and your products? And so
yeah. Yeah, it's Alan McGee. All lowercase. It's alanmcgee.blogspot.com with a /after the .com. So alanmcgee.blogspot.com/.
Okay, got it. All right. Good. All right. Well, we had a couple questions. I think you've answered these, but if you want to say anything more about them, please. Jerry and Bertha asked, what feathers are best for soft tackles, especially 16 through 22? And if I heard you right, is you know, you can use any of the feathers if you're using the tips and so forth, right? You can get it to decide.
Yeah, there's compensation methods you can use, like the rearward compensation hackle collar method, which allows you to take a larger feather and tie it on a smaller hook. So, you know, but for wrapping a feather, you know, you got to have the right size feather for the hook, obviously. So some of the smaller feathers would be things like, you know, like I said, the partridge up near the neck. Make sure you get like a full skin of partridge. Don't buy the bagged stuff. You know, you want a full skin because you'll get all the size feathers on it. And the smaller feathers will be up near, right behind the neck, on the back of the neck, and on the head. So you want the head on it, too. You know, I have a couple that even have the beaks on them still. So, get a full skin of partridge, and you can use the smaller feathers up near the neck. The India hen necks are good. The Brahma hen tip fibers from the Brahma hen saddles are good. And you can always use starling. Starling, really small feathers on starling. I even have some bleached starling that, usually starling just used to come in black, it was all black. But I have like purple, yellow, and orange, and a bleached starling, I believe. So you can find dyed starling now, which is kind of cool. And those feathers will tie down as small as you can find hooks.
Okay. Okay.
Yep.
CJ in Coventry, Connecticut writes, Hungarian partridge seems to be the most popular hackle for a wet fly. What are some good alternatives? And I know you just ran through a whole bunch of them that you like, but is there any particular alternative
Hungarian partridge? Sure. The Brahma hen saddle in mottled gray is very, very similar to the mottled gray partridge. It's actually a little softer than the partridge. Brahma hen mottled gray is similar to partridge. Nothing is exactly like partridge, though. I mean, that's probably why it's still my favorite feather. It's so unique, and so you can use it for so many different kind of flies and so many different colors on them. The mottled India hen necks are good, like I said, and I stated that earlier. But if you want, there's no substitute for partridge, I don't think, really, to be honest with you. I mean, there's things that come close, but that's why it's the most popular feather for a reason, you know.
Yeah. Peter Brown, Oakland, California, writes, when do you prefer soft versus stiff hackle? And he has in parentheses partridge versus henback.
Uh-huh.
And go ahead and
answer.
That's
a good
question. Three questions here. So.
Okay. So I'll use a stiffer hackle in my dry flies more, just to give it not a dry fly hackle, but to give it a little bit of better floatability. So that's India hen cape or the genetic hen cape. Genetic hen cape's a little stiffer than the India hen cape, like I said. A softer feather like a marabou or a partridge or grouse, those would be mostly for subsurface flies, things that I don't want any floatability in. But you can get a little bit of floatability out of a stiffer hen cape feather. But again, I use that on my dry fly, like my soft tackle dry flies and my soft tackle spinners. So that's kind of where I go stiff for a little bit better floatability, yet still some action. And then if I want a really soft feather, it would just be for my subsurface flies only, like diving egg layers and emergers and things like that.
Hey, Peter also asked, when do you prefer sparse, few turns of hackle versus several turns of hackle? What difference, if any, does hackle length make in your experience?
Hackle length can make a difference because it can kind of take away from, if you overhackle a fly, especially longer than needed, it'll kind of cover up the body itself and you won't even be able to see what you're trying to imitate if you are trying to imitate a certain specific species. So as far as how many turns I make of the hackle, I kind of talked about that. It depends on the water type I'm fishing and what species of insect I'm trying to imitate. For instance, if I'm trying to imitate a caddis in riffle water, I'll make it with a lot, I'll maybe make four turns of hackle because I want to have a lot of action in it, The fish are probably not going to be as selective in that riffle water and they're going to be a little bit more opportunistic. So I want to catch their eye, you know what I mean? And a more action fly, a fly with more turns of hackle is going to have more action to it, and it hopefully will catch their eye better. Now, if I'm fishing a flat like Silver Creek or the Henry's Fork or something, and I'm fishing a surface fly like a soft tackle spinner, I'll just make like one or maybe two turns of hackle, and it'll be a thin hackle, like the hen cape, which will have real fine fibers on it. So most of the body will be more prevalent than the hackle. That's kind of the idea. It depends on the water type and how the fish are feeding, the selectivity and things like that, for the type of feather I use and for how many times I hackle it.
Bill in San Carlos, California asks, what are your tips for tying soft tackles, mainly how to wrap the partridge tackle for great looking flies and effective results.
Cool. So most of the time I'll use the tip fibers like I talked about because they're the shorter fibers, and the stem is thinner at the tip. So you don't get the bulk of the stem in the hackle wrap. So, you know, basically how I do it is I take, let's say, a partridge feather, and I'll take a pair of hackle pliers, and I'll just grab the very tip of the feather with the hackle pliers, just like a couple fibers at the very tip. Then I'll kind of stroke all the fibers back, and then the tip fibers that are still in the hackle pliers, I unhook the hackle pliers, and that's what I tie in. I'll sometimes cut it a little shorter, just have a little notch there, and that'll be the tie-in for the hackle. That's what I tie onto the hook. And then I just grab the stem with the hackle pliers again of the stem of the feather, and then I'll wrap it. But I'm doing tip tie-in using as few fibers as possible to get the shortest, you know, to get the rest of the fibers to be the shortest at the tip there.
Okay.
So then, and then if you keep, you know, and like I said earlier, the more you wrap it, not only the bulkier does the hackle get, and, you know, you can, and that goes back to the design of the water type you're fishing in, but it also, the fibers will usually start to get longer as you wrap too, so you don't want to wrap too many times. And then, you know, maybe two or three wraps, and then I trap the stem with the thread, clip it off, and then make the head, and it's done.
Okay. Bob Garman in Philadelphia asks, what's the difference between a sparsely tied wet, just thread for a body, and one with a dubbed body, and when should I be fishing each one?
Well, I use thread bodies mostly on smaller hooks, like 20s and smaller, and mostly for midges and maybe blue wing olives, you know, small little 22 blue wing olives, just because you want it to look as sparse as possible on those little flies. And, you know, I'll just use a thread color that simulates the natural body color. So like a black midge would just be black thread body, and maybe like a starling hackle, just two materials, mm-hmm. And that's it. But you can tie that down to size 26, 28 if you wanted to. So it's mostly the hook size if I use a thread body. And as the flies get larger, I'll go to, you know, dub bodies once they hit about size 18 and larger, obviously. But I kind of just do it to simulate how small the flies are. You don't need a dub body on a size 24 fly, you know.
Yeah, and, yeah.
There's no reason for that.
There's no bulk there. Yeah.
It's hard to keep it sparse, and the effort it takes to keep it sparse, you might as well just not even use dubbing at all.
Yeah. Okay, time for another break, Alan. And when we come back, we'll dig more into how to tie these flies and get the best results. So hang with me, and I'll be right back. Baja Fly Fishing Company is dedicated to fulfilling your vacation dreams. And just so there is no mistake, they derive as much pleasure helping a novice improve as they do fishing with a pro. From the casual to the hardcore, they can match your expectations with their experience at coaching. A vacation with Baja Fly Fishing is more than a fishing trip. It's a full-on Baja experience that you will remember forever. They know the Baja after 40 years of traveling its back roads, kayaking its shoreline, surfing, and snorkeling while pioneering the fly fishing techniques that have evolved into the tactics used today. They are well-versed in fly fishing the beach, in kayaks, on pongos, and are well-versed in all tackle types. Join them in pursuit of roosterfish, dorado, marlin, sailfish, wahoo, jack crevalle, yellowfin, skipjack, and many other species. Learn more about Baja Fly Fishing Company by visiting their website at www.bajaflyfish.com. That's bajaflyfish.com. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We're talking with Alan McGee about fly fishing soft tackles. If you'd like to ask Alan a question, just go to our homepage, askaboutflyfishing.com. Use that Q&A text box there to send in your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. Okay, Alan, let's see. We've got some questions on weight here. Richard in Colorado Springs wants to know, should wet flies be tied with weight to get them to the bottom of the river and then on the swing they rise, or just tie them unweighted so they just sit in the upper level of the water column at all the time?
Yeah. Well, I mean, it depends on where the fish are, doesn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, there you go.
No, really, where they're holding, where they're holding. Like, you know, sometimes they're holding under the surface looking for terrestrials, or sometimes they're deep, you know, down on the bottom. So you got to find the fish, basically, and some, and it depends on the water you're fishing. You know, if you're fishing a deeper river with a lot of pocket water, riffles, things like that, they could be anywhere, right? They could be on, they could be near the surface, or they could be, you know, if you don't see any risers, you don't know where they are when you start fishing, if you're prospect nymphing that day. So what I do is, let's just say I'm fishing a river and, you know, there's no surface activity or anything hatching, and I'm trying to find the depth of fish are at that day. So I fish, I'm either fishing one, two, or three flies, okay? And if I'm prospect nymphing and it's in pocket water, riffle water, things like that, and it's somewhat deep, I'm going to probably be fishing three flies, and I'll fish three levels of it. I'll fish the bottom, the middle, and the surface with the flies as two droppers on top and my point fly. And they're all differently weighted to find the fish. So in other words, my point fly is the heaviest, the middle fly is the middle-weighted fly, and the top dropper is going to be an unweighted or a lighter fly. They might be different sizes. They might be different colors. They might be different species, like maybe mayfly nymph on the point fly, a caddis larva on the middle fly, and a caddis pupa on the top dropper. So that's a three-fly setup. And, again, the weights go into determining the level I'm going to be fishing. If I'm finding all the fish on the bottom, if all the fish are being caught on that point fly, which is the heaviest fly, I might switch the other two flies to heavier flies and fish just three flies on the bottom. Or if they're all being taken on the surface, I might take off the heavy point fly and the middle weight middle fly and fish three lighter weight flies just under the surface and prospecting that way. So basically I'm locating the fish with the depth and with the fly weight I'm using. And I like to incorporate it into the fly and not into the leader, like with split shot, unless I have to, because I like to be able to feel out to the, I don't use strike indicators, and I like to be able to feel out to that point fly, right? And that way I'm feeling the strikes. There's a fine line between dragging the fly and having slack that you'll miss the strike detection. But if you fish long enough and learn how to nymph right, there's a fine line between dragging the fly and having it too much slack and not detecting the strike. But anyway, if I weight the flies themselves, I can feel the strikes, and the fish basically will set the hook on themselves, and I'm not even having to do much to set the hook. Maybe slightly lifting the rod tip is all.
Right.
So I can detect strike. And I talk about that in my book, how to build leaders, and how to use Duncan Loop droppers. And I also sell the leaders if anybody's interested in looking, if they don't want to have to tie them themselves, because there are a number of blood knots, but I don't use the blood knots for static droppers. I'm using them just as stops, and I have slideable droppers with Duncan loops between the blood knots that I can position, and then they'll stay in that position until a fish takes the fly, and then they'll stop at the blood knot. And it actually has some give to it, too, which helps if you don't get a good hook set on the fish. The dropper will slide until it hits the blood knot, and it allows you to get a little better hook set rather than like with a static dropper that's tied as part of the blood knot, where just pull is either in the fish or it's not in the fish. But I don't know if anybody, you know, like I said, I talk about it in my book, and I show how to build the leaders, and but I also do sell them if anybody wants to buy a leader.
Sure, great. Yeah. CJ, again, asked another question, Coventry, Connecticut. Since I tie my own soft tackles, my question is regarding bead heads. Some like the added weight flash on the fly. Others feel it hinders the natural action of the fly in the water. What are your thoughts?
Mm-hmm. It's kind of the same answer. It's depending on where the fish are. You have to do something to reach the fish, right? And those three things are you can either not fish to the fish, which I knew a guy who once said, he said he refuses to fish weight in his flies. And I said, well, what if the fish are deep? And he says, well, sit on the bank and smoke a cigar. I'm like, all right. You know, I want to catch fish when I fish.
Yeah.
And I'm not ashamed to reach the fish with any weight I put in my fly. Or, yeah. You know what I mean? But some traditional wet fly fishermen don't think there should be any weight in a fly. And so they just refuse to fish deep. And sometimes you got to fish deep. And so that's why I fish heavy point fly. If I'm prospecting, I'm finding the fish on a daily basis. Now, this is, again, back to if there's no rising fish or any surface activity, but I'm prospecting and finding where they are in the water column. So I like to build it into the fly for my point fly. And then if I find fish taking that point fly consistently, that means they're deep, and I'm gonna fish two or three flies deep like that. So it depends on where the fish are, and I don't think it affecting the action of the fly itself. I think it actually can help with the action of the fly, because you can actually lift the fly, you know, lifting the rod tip, raising it off the stream bed, then dropping your rod tip down and letting the fly drop, kind of that jigging action, right? So you can, if you have weight in your fly, you can do that. If you don't have weight in your fly is really going to only drift at one level.
Yeah. There's another question related to that. Dino in Michigan says, do metal beads make a wet fly into a nymph? What is the difference? Is there really, I mean, you're just taking a nymph in many cases, or an emerger, and adding different kinds of action to them, correct?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, again, my soft tackles are imitating light, soft tackle nymphs, which are usually going to be deeper, the flints, which are the emergers, or the adults, or the dry flies on the surface, and the egg layers and spinners. But adding weight to the fly, again, makes it a nymph. Yeah, it's more where you're fishing it in the water column that determines what life stage it is.
Right.
You know, yeah, putting weight on the fly or a bead head, or, you know what I also do sometimes, I don't just use bead heads, because it shortens basically the body length of what the fly is. So say you're wanting to imitate a number 16 nymph, you know, PMB nymph or whatever. If you put a bead head on the head, you basically kind of shortened what appears to be the body of the fly. Do you see what I'm saying? So
right.
What I do is I put I'll put the bead on the thorax, and then put a hackle collar in front of the bead, and then the head. So I have abdomen, bead, thorax, soft tackle collar, and then head finish. And so the bead becomes part of the body, as opposed to being part of the head of the fly.
Yeah. Question from Dan.
They'll both give you that weight.
Yeah. Dan in Miami, Florida, what are your thoughts about the motion, the reverse hackle, often used on tenkara flies? Is tenkara fishing or are those fly styles popular in South Korea where you have fish?
South Korea, no. It's a Japanese form of fishing.
Yeah.
And perhaps at one time it was in South Korea, but when I lived in South Korea, it was mostly Western-style fly fishing. And South Korea is interesting because there's no fishing licenses in the country. You don't have to have a fishing license. There's a smaller group of fishermen there, but they're a dedicated group of fishermen. There's actually 7 fly shops in Seoul, if you can believe it, which is pretty cool. Yeah, there's 7 fly shops there. And they're just like Western fly shops here, you know. They have the same equipment, all the same kind of stuff. But back to the tenkara, you know, it's all about imitation of life and action in the fly and imitating life, and that's what soft tackle collars do, whether you tie them forward-facing or rearward-facing. You know, the tenkara flies catch fish because they look alive. And that's the same as why soft tackles catch fish, because they look alive. So there's no difference in why they work. I wouldn't say there's a difference in why they work, you know. It's just more about how you want to fish, if you want to use a reel or not, and if you want to fish a tenkara fly.
you know.
And the funny thing about it is the tenkara, I have a book called Spiders to Flints, which was my second book, and I kind of talk about the evolution of the soft tackle wet fly in depth, and I kind of show how it's always been evolving. You know, a lot of people kind of afraid of modern soft tackle, some of the traditionalists. I wanted to show everybody that this kind of soft tackles have always been evolving from the day they started North Country Spiders, you know, up through the guys like Charlie Brooks and Sylvester Neems. And then into today, you know, there's always been an evolution of it. But the interesting thing is about the tenkara is in Italy, they were actually using that same kind of frontward-facing hackle on their flies over in Italy at the same time the Japanese were doing it with Tenkara flies. And, you know, so it's kind of, there's nothing new, in other words, you know, with any of that. But they work because they look alive. And
Now, that brings up a question that, you know, I'm looking through your book right now on all these patterns. And we've got everything from a pheasant tail to an ant to a scud to, you know, nymphs. I mean, just everything with the soft tackle on it. So do you have, do you fish any flies without a soft tackle? I mean, do you feel like that's an attribute?
No, I don't. I mean, I used to, you know, I used to, like, fish soft tackles just as they were intended, like as spiders or, you know, something like that, maybe soft tackle nymphs, but only as wet flies. And then I would switch to, like, you know, a parachute-type dry fly or something like that. But then I was just like, I think it'd be – but then what I did with the soft tackle collar is I did the two-stage life presentation. In other words, I talked about where you can fish it as an adult on the first half of your presentation, and then you can pull it underwater and fish it as, like, an emerger or a bent spinner or a diving egg layer. But it's two presentations in that one – two stages in that one presentation. So I put the soft tackle collar on it to give it kind of that swimming motion underwater when I'm imitating the second half of the, when I'm imitating the emerger or the diving egg layer life stage. So that's why I have it even on my dry flies. And I put it on all, you know, my terrestrials, you know, nymphs, everything. So, yeah.
Okay. Jim in Ohio asks, when tying, it seems the body is always made shorter than on my usual nymphs. Slash flies, I want to say it stops before the hook point. Is this tradition? Does it serve a purpose?
So I think he's talking about the traditional sort of North Country style of tying, where you don't go all the way back to the hook bend when you tie the body.
Okay.
And I don't. My flies don't really. I don't really do that. I'll use the right hook size to the fly to the size I want to tie, and I'll cover the, you know, hook shank, and sometimes I'll even carry it around to the hook bend. You know, everybody thinks you got to stop your body right where the bend starts, but if you continue on, like, you know, you continue down the bend with the body, you give it kind of that curvature shape to it. Again, back to the caddis pupa or the imitation of life where nothing is straight, you know what I mean?
Right.
So you have that shape. So sometimes I'll continue down into the past even where the bend starts with my fly.
Sure, like with your scud patterns. Things like that.
Right. With scud patterns, but not only, but I'd even use it on a straight, like a Kiemco 3761, right, like a nymph hook like that, you know, which normally is a straight hook, but you can tie it into the bend, too. You can continue down. There's nothing that says you have to stop right on the top of the shank like that. So you can get some shape out of your body. You don't have to use a complete scud hook, but you can use a straight shank hook, but just continue it down the bend a little bit to give it a little curvature of the body there.
Yeah. Scott Nelson in Portland, Oregon asks, what specific soft tackles do you recommend for specific hatches or streams or rivers? I guess he's asking, are some hackles better for certain types of insects?
Well, if you look at my book, I've broken it down into basically all the life stages on all the, you know, starting with mayflies. So it's really, you know, and then so if we're talking about dry fly fishing or, I mean, hatch fishing, you know, where there's a hatch going on, I try to be as realistic as possible yet still have some impressionistic in the flight. You know what I'm saying? There's kind of a balance between the two. So you have movement from fibers, but then you also have the color and, like, the thorax on, like, a pupa might be a chartreuse on, like, a granum pupa, and then you go into a brown thorax, which is realistic of the natural, the same color contrast there. And so I try to be as realistic as possible if I'm fishing and I know the species that are hatching, right? Now, you know, if I'm just prospecting, I'll use more impressionistic flies, like searching patterns that don't represent any specific mayfly species or caddis species. But, I mean, again, if you, my book breaks it down, there's not one fly that I would say, you know, matches every single mayfly. Because it's basically dependent on, you got to understand the behavior of the species. For instance, like a lot of sulfurs that I fish up on the South Holston River, a lot of guys fish dry flies there all the time. But if you look down in the water as these hatches are going on, you'll see hundreds of drifting nymphs just about 3 or 4 inches under the surface.
Right.
And they drift for 100 yards before they emerge. And so that's the behavior I'm matching. So I'm going to fish, even during a hatch, I'm going to fish a nymph, a floating nymph, just under the surface, right? Or maybe a transition nymph, where half the body, the abdomen is the nymph, and then the front half is the adult breaking out of the shell, nymphal shuck. But I'm going to fish it underwater, just in front of the fish, just a couple inches underwater, to imitate those drifting nymphs. I mean, I was up on the South Holston, and I fish a lot of downstream presentations like that, like a downstream parachute cast. So I'll be right upstream from the fish, directly upstream, about maybe 20 feet, and I'll be facing downstream towards him. And if he's rising, and a lot of these fish that are rising, you'd think that they're rising taking guns, but they're actually just their backs coming out of the water, and they're taking those drifting nymphs under the surface, right? So I'll fish downstream to those fish, showing that it's a fly-first presentation, where all I have to do is lower my rod tip, and I can feed the fly right into that fish's mouth, and again, it's like a drifting nymph under the surface and during sulfur hatch, and there's no drag at all because I'm not cross-current from the fish. I'm in the same current lane, and all I have to do is lower the rod tip at the same rate to keep the pace with the water, and I can feed it right into that fish. And I was fishing there one time, and all these guys were fishing dry flies, and I was catching fish, and they, you know, I was fishing downstream, and they were all fishing either cross stream or dry flies. And about 30 minutes later, I looked up, and they were all fishing downstream just like I was trying to. You know.
At least they're good learners.
Yeah. I don't know if they knew what I was doing, but they were trying, you know.
Yeah. Question from Dave Wanton in Arkansas. Davey's been on our show, and he's kind of a wet fly master as well. But he asked the hard question here. If you only had 3 patterns to use for any trout water in the world, what would be your choice?
Yeah, I saw that question. I was ready for it, too. So 3 flies, and I mean, I'm not going to say this is the ultimate 3 flies, but this is 3 just off the top of my head, okay? And these probably, you know. So pheasant tail soft tackle, and I'd have to say with and without a bead head, bead thorax, that is. Uh-huh. Bead thorax, I was telling you about the bead thorax I use instead of bead head. Right. So I'd want for a weighted version and an unweighted version. That counts as 1 fly, right? Even though one has a bead and one doesn't. Okay, that's 1 fly. And I'd carry that in 12 through 20, because that'll imitate a lot of different mayfly nymph species, okay? Then I'd have a granum contrast pupa, which is one of my flies that I tie. It's basically a contrast between the abdomen and thorax. It's just a soft tackle pupa. But
what's
I would, the granum contrast, it's a, the granum contrast pupa. And actually, I mean, I was telling you I sold those leaders. I also sell these contrast dubbing sets. They're called Riverfly Life Stage contrast dubbing sets. And they're species-specific dubbing sets. So in other words, and one of the flies that is on the back to show how to tie is the contrast pupa. And you basically, it's you can try these dubbing sets. There's 2 colors. Like, for instance, I'm looking at the granum right now. It has chartreuse and brown packaged dubbing in it. And I make these myself. But on the back, it has 2 flies you can tie with the same materials. And just by taking the abdomen and making the abdomen brown and the thorax, you know, like greenish chartreuse, you get a Peking caddis soft tackle larva. And then by switching it to the chartreuse abdomen and brown thorax, you get a contrast pupa, which imitates the pupa. So basically it's the same materials, and all you're doing is switching the abdomen and thorax color to get 2 different life stages. So anyway, back to his question. That's the granum contrast pupa, and I would carry that to imitate caddis pupa for hatches, and it's a great fly just for prospecting, you know. Caddis are good prospecting flies. And I would carry that in a 14 through an 18. And then the 3rd fly would be a wet ant. a wet ant. And I tie, like with this, you know, the loon hardhead, they usually use it for finishing heads. I make wet ants with a loon hardhead, like in black and orange and red. And I carry a black wet ant in a 12 through 18. And wet ants are just killer. I was fishing Odell Creek, Spring Creek out in Ennis, Montana, when I was out in Livingston for the show out there. And the whole day long, all I fished was wet ants on the Meadow Spring Creek and did quite well. A long time ago, about maybe 15 years ago, I wrote George Harvey a letter, and I asked him a few questions. And one of the questions I asked him was, what fly has he caught more fish on in his lifetime? And his answer was a black ant.
Wow.
And that was George Harvey.
That's something I hardly ever fish. I got to start fishing it.
Right. So basically, my three flies are a mayfly nymph with a pheasant tail soft tackle,
right,
a contrast pupa for covers the caddis, and a wet ant covers my terrestrials.
Yeah, yeah. And it's funny how that pheasant tail always comes up as a favorite, you know, no matter how many new patterns are out there, that old pheasant tail still.
Well, because it imitates so many different mayfly nymphs. I mean, they're all brown, basically.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
or some version of it.
Right.
And then the pheasant tail, and then the soft tackle collar just gives it a little bit of action, which makes the pattern, I think, even better because it has a little bit of movement and life to it. So, there you go.
Okay. So, going to talk more here about strategy and presentation. Larry Neusser, Cleveland, Ohio, says, I've had very little opportunity to fish soft tackle flies, although I have several of your books and would like to fish them more. I'm very interested in learning more about how they are presented. Could you please help out someone new to the art and start at a basic level with the alternative ways of presenting? So maybe you can just, you know, outline maybe three different ways that you normally do presentation.
Okay. Well, you know, there's the traditional wet fly swing, which is, you know, you're basically up and across stream cast, and then as the fly, you know, there's no action to it. You're not stripping the line. You're not dead drifting it. It dead drifts across from you, but then it starts to swing as it reaches downstream, across and downstream, and swings across and below you. So that's your traditional wet fly swing. And, you know, I still use it, but I use variations on it. Sometimes I'll mend with, like, hump mends, which will throw a couple mends into my upstream, cross-stream cast. That allows the fly to sink faster. And so I can get it deep with just mending. Sometimes you even need a lot of weight. But anyway, those mends will drop the fly and kind of sets up the rest of my presentation. I'm not even really expecting to catch fish. I'm setting it up. I'm setting up the fly for the cross-stream and down and across swing, you know. But sometimes even those hump mends, when you make them, it'll kind of make the fly jump, and if there's a fish there, they'll get a quick strike as the fly enters the water just on the first year cast there. But, you know, so you have the traditional wet fly swing and the hump mending. So sometimes I'll add action with stripping the fly. What I try to do is when I first make a presentation, I try to make it as dead drift as possible through a run. To not give the fish any kind of spookiness or anything. So in other words, it won't have any action to the fly other than just like a high stick dead drift. You know what I'm saying? So this is for nymphing. And then I'll continue to add a little bit of action to the fly with each subsequent presentation. So the next presentation I might do a swing of the fly. So the first presentation is dead drift. Second presentation, swing. Third presentation, maybe the mending, and then the swinging and a little bit of stripping as the fly is swinging. You can do line tugs where you pull in the line, but you're not stripping it in, but you're kind of just pulling it in and kind of moving your arm, tugging on it, and then not letting go of the line. So those are a few actions you can add to it. Another thing you can do is what I call, you know, the figure eight retrieve. A lot of people use it for retrieving only. And you can use it for retrieving, which adds some action to the fly, but I use it for what I call figure eight line management. And instead of just retrieving line with the figure eight mend, or with figure eight management rather, you can actually release it into the drift to keep the fly from swinging across. so you can extend the drift across stream from you for as much line as you have on your hand in that figure eight pattern. And all you have to do is hold your fingers out, and the current will pull the line off at the, off your fingers at the same rate that the current's drifting, which will not allow the swing to take place and allow the fly to stay across stream for, you know, for as long as you want, pretty much as long as much as line as you have on your fingers. And then you can retrieve it again back onto your fingers with the figure eight retrieve, and or you can just stop it and let it swing across stream. The final one that I like to use, even the figure eight is really a good way. It basically allows you to get a long dead drift. So not all my fishing is done with swinging of the fly. Not all of it's done with the traditional methods. I also use modern nymphing techniques with my nymphing. So in other words, I'll use high stick nymphing. I use longer rods. I'll use a 10-foot four weight rod to reach out over the current to, you know, prevent drag. The figure eight method is really a great way. And some guys will just feed line out, you know, to prolong that drift. But if you have it on your fingers, the current will pull it off your fingers at the same rate that the fly is drifting. And then finally, what you can do with a figure eight that's kind of cool is you can, what I call sweeping methods, where you're basically facing downstream, and this is a lot of times in faster water, but you can sweep the fly from section to section across stream, and you can let out line with the figure eight to kind of make like a U-shaped drift out of your fly. And so it's not total sweeping just left and right. It's kind of sweeping left and right with a little bit of an arc to it. And I do that on the Madison a lot.
Can you describe what you mean by figure eight?
Right. So you know the figure eight retrieve. It's a way of retrieving line and holding it on your line hand in a figure eight pattern. You'll have to look. It's in my book, but you look up figure eight retrieve. And it's a way of kind of, you weave the line onto your hand. It's a way of retrieving it, but it's retrieved on in a figure eight pattern through your fingers. And it's held on your hand like that, right? And it's normally
rather
used for retrieving
down,
line.
Yeah, rather than hanging down and into the water, it's all on
right.
your hand.
Right. You're holding all the, maybe you got maybe 20 feet of line on your hand. That's what you got. And so you got 20 feet of excess of line in a figure eight pattern on your line hand. And you've got it on your hand using the retrieve method. Now, once you retrieved it, like, so what you can do, but I keep it there even, like, throughout all my presentations. I have this reserve of line on my left hand. It's not hanging down on the water. It's not on the reel. It's on my hand. And I can let it out into the drift, or I can retrieve it back onto my hand. But it allows me to, again, let line out into the drift or retrieve the fly to give it action or to shorten up the line as well. So really, it's a reserve. My left hand is being used as a reserve of line that I can feed into the drift, or I can retrieve it back from the drift.
Right. Gotcha.
Yeah.
Okay. This one, Kenny Klein, St. Louis, Missouri. When fishing soft tackles and the trout are hitting very light, subtle hits, I learned a technique from Gary Borger that when you feel or see the hit, basically let go of the line, let it ride through your fingers, and the trout will most often set the hook itself. Do you ever use this method on very subtle hits? Do you know what he's talking about?
Yeah. Well, I won't drop the line. If I do drop the line, I'll lift the rod tip at the same time, and it's called a slip strike. And in other words, the line running through the rod guides will be enough tension to set the hook. But I find that if I have the right balance of my drift and I feel the strike, just the fish striking itself, I don't have a lot of slack, but they're not dead. I'm not dragging the fly either. Again, it's that balance I was talking about earlier. It's hard to describe it. You just have to, it's a balance between dragging the fly and having too much slack, but I'm in contact with the flies. And when I'm in contact with the flies, a simple, like 1-inch rod tip lift, if even that much, is enough to set the hook. Actually, the fish is really setting the hook on themselves. And so I don't even have to pull with the line hand. I don't have to drop the line at all. The strike is the set. The fish striking is the hook set. And if I do any hook setting, it's only a very slight little lift in my rod tip, just to get it in there a little tight.
We got Gil and
I don't try to drop the line off the because if you drop the line, sometimes you'll introduce slack into it, and slack isn't a good thing.
Yeah.
You don't want too much tension either. So. Yeah.
Okay, Gil in Merced, California writes, in your book, you talk about almost any water is good for soft tackle. I've had best luck in riffles, especially longer ones. My question is, how do you control the depth of the fly when swinging across, swinging cross current and trying to stay in deeper water?
Okay, well, that goes back to a couple things. The figure eight method, I can let line out. Letting line out is going to take tension off the line and let the fly drop. I can also make mends. Even during the drift, I can make hump mends, which are basically throwing the line upstream or downstream, you know, throwing the line like a little reach cast, and giving the mend, putting a mend into the line, which will allow the fly to drop, and that'll keep it deep. Another thing you can do is just your high sticking methods. If you want a deep drift, you want to keep line off the water, and if line is on the water, you want it to have, you know, not too much tension on it, which will raise the fly to the surface. And then it also goes back to the balance of weight in the fly. So it's a whole system of weight to leader length to tippet length to depth to presentation to mending to the figure eight line management. All those things combined are how I get a deep drift. And that's basically it. Also, if you fish two or three flies, they can weight each other. If you fish a couple heavy, you know, a heavy point fly and a heavy middle fly, whatever, they're going to weight each other. And so they're going to act like split shot on each other. And that'll help you get deep drift as well. And that's even before you add any split shot onto the leader.
Yeah.
So mending is, and I'll mention one more thing here. I use double taper lines, and they're getting harder to find every day. Not because of the reason why you can turn them around and have more line. I like the fact that I'm always, because I do a lot of mending to keep those deep drifts. And if you get past 30 feet on a weight forward line, you're throwing running line and you're trying to mend into the belly. It doesn't work. But if you have a double taper line, you're always mending heavier line into lighter line, even if you have more than 30 feet of line out on the water. So I use double tapers for mending at past 30 feet.
Dino in Michigan asked, really enjoyed your book. Do you fish wet flies differently to imitate mayflies versus caddis flies?
Do I fish them differently to imitate mayflies?
Caddis flies?
Yeah.
I kind of talked about this earlier.
I'll give you an example. Well, let's just talk about emergers, I guess, because mayfly nymphs and caddis larvae will both be fish maybe the same. But when you get into the emergent stages, there's different behaviors of each. And I was talking to you about the sulfur hatch and how the sulfurs will just dead drift under the surface for 100, 200 yards before they emerge. Well, caddis isn't going to dead drift under the surface for 100 yards, a caddis pupa. It's going to swim to the surface as quickly as it can and try to get off the water quickly. So you would fish a caddis with more action to imitate that behavior, whereas you would fish those mayfly nymphs in a situation like a sulfur hatch or a PMD hatch where there's a lot of drifting nymphs under the surface. You'd try to fish those as dead drift as you could, and to imitate the other ones, you're not going to want a lot of action because all the fish are seeing 100 nymphs around it, and they're all dead drifting. And if your fly is scooting around all over the place, it's not going to look very natural to them.
Yeah.
So that's just one example.
Yeah. He also asked, Dino also wrote in another question. Do you have any special techniques to imitate mayfly spinners or ovipositing caddis flies?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay, so let's say mayfly spinners are going to, you know, be dead drift as they lay their eggs on the surface, and then the females, you know, they're going to eventually sink underwater, and they're going to be spent, and so you're going to want to fish them completely dead drift the whole time. There's not going to be any diving or swimming associated with those kind of flies. So back to my soft tackle spinner techniques where I fish at dead drift to rising fish, and as the fly starts to drag when it's down and across stream from me, instead of just picking it up and fishing another dead drift presentation of it, I'll actually pull it underwater first just to get it to, you know, sink underwater. And then I'll make a couple mends, those hump mends again, to give it a dead drift for about 5 or 6 feet so it can dead drift just like a sunken spinner, which would be an appropriate behavior of a mayfly spinner, a sunken mayfly spinner. Whereas a caddis diver is, you know, they actually have a behavior where they crawl underwater or dive underwater or skitter on the surface to lay eggs. And then they lay their eggs, if they do dive under or crawl underwater to lay eggs on rocks or structure, they actually swim back to the surface, which I completely don't understand. But they'll swim back up to the surface just to be spent on the surface. But their life cycle's over at that point. But they will, so they'll dive underwater, lay eggs, and then swim back. So fish have two opportunities to eat them, both on the diving and on the swimming back up to the top. But, you know, once they get to the top, they just lay flat on the spent on the top with outsplayed wings, you know, and just drift like a dead, you know, mayfly spinner. But let's see, so there's differences there. So you would fish more action to the caddis egg layer, right, because of all the diving and swimming it's doing. But the mayfly is going to be dead drift the whole time.
Yeah, yeah. Well, one thing I learned tonight that I didn't know before talking with you is that, you know, adding this lifelike, you know, soft hackle can be done to almost any kind of fly that you're fishing, and that one needs to pay a lot of attention to that life cycle and what not only what the imitation is imitating, but also its movement in the water to make this whole thing work. And it just sounds like, you know, you've paid a lot of attention to, you know, what's actually happening. You know, it's not just, yeah, oh, well, I'm throwing a merger out there and see what happens. Mm-hmm. You know what's going on. Mm-hmm. You're fishing, and I think a lot of us don't spend that kind of attention to that kind of detail. So, really appreciate you spending time.
I'll just mention that. Watch as many. I wish there was more, but I watch as many entomology videos as you can of these mayflies and caddisflies underwater, because you'll learn a lot. And then you can start to think about how you fish and tie your flies and design your flies to imitate that behavior.
Yeah. So. Yeah, good. Well, we're out of time, Alan. But stick with me, because we're going to be giving away a copy of your book, Fly Fishing Soft Tackles, which I'm sure everyone will want a copy of after this talk. And it is a stack full book. I'm sure you can get it at your website or Amazon or a number of different places, but a great book, all kinds of patterns in there, just about everything you'll need to tie soft tackles. So check Alan's book out for sure tonight if you don't win it, but hang tight, you might win it. So we'll also be giving away a one-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers and a one-year subscription to the Fly Fishing and Tying Journal. So hang with me, everybody, and we'll be right back, and we'll be giving away those prizes. Family Ties, that's T-Y-E-S. Family Ties is an organization which uses a shared interest in fly fishing and fly tying to enhance youth development and family relationships. They utilize resources in schools, communities, and businesses, and they invite your participation. Go to their website, www.familyties.com. That's family and then T-Y-E-S.com. Family Ties, where every fish is a trophy and every kid is a hero. Just a quick reminder to everyone, before you leave the website tonight, please take a minute and give us your feedback about the show. You can find a link on our homepage in the section under tonight's show that says, what did you think of the show? Just click on that link and leave your comments. We'd really appreciate it. Well, now it's time to give away a few prizes. The winners for our drawings are randomly selected from the show's registration database. If you didn't register for tonight's show, it's a little late now, but make sure you do so next time around so you can have a chance at winning some of these nice prizes that we have for you. Let me get my database up here and running, and we will get these gifts given out. Okay, so 1-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers. We, hold on here. Okay. Let's see who we have. Looks like our winner for that is Stephen Bodenstab. Stephen, congratulations. And let me just jot your name down here. So if you didn't win, if you're not Stephen, Stephen's in Illinois, go to fedflyfishers.org, fedflyfishers.org, and you'll learn more about what the Federation has to offer you as a fly fisher. Now we're going to give away a 1-year membership or subscription to the Fly Fishing and Tying Journal. And our winner for that is, come on here, looks like our winner is, sorry, folks, technical difficulties here on this. Looks like Scott Nelson. Scott Nelson in Oregon. So, Scott, congratulations. I know we've talked. And you now have a 1-year subscription to the Fly Fishing and Tying Journal. So, and Scott's out in Oregon. So, congratulations. Okay, now, the question for tonight's grand prize, which is Alan McGee's Fly Fishing, Soft Tackles, Nymphs, Emergers, and Dry Flies. Great book from Stackpole. And to find out more about Stackpole, go to stackpolebooks.com and check out what they have to offer. A lot of great books out there. And the question, it's going to be a two-part question tonight. Let me clear my view here. Two-part question. Does Alan prefer to have the weight in his flies or on his line? And name one of the three go-to patterns that he mentioned earlier. All right, two-part question. Weight on the fly or the line, and one of the patterns that he mentioned earlier. So, Alan, we're waiting to see what kind of answers we get here. It's refreshing the queue. See if we can find a winner out there. It's a great book, guys, by the way. And if you don't win, which most of you won't tonight, looks like the first answer might be a winner here. Alan, you tell me. He says, weight on the fly and a wet ant.
That's correct.
Does that work? Okay, good. Then Gil H. from Merced, California, you're the proud winner and owner of Alan's book, Fly Fishing Soft Tackles. So, Gil, what you need to do is send me your full name and your address so that we can get this sent out from Stackpole to you. You can just put it back into the text box that you answered the question in, and then we can get this book sent out to you. So, congratulations. Thanks, guys and gals, for playing and participating tonight and listening in. We really appreciate all the questions. There are many questions we didn't get to. Sorry about that, but we only got 90 minutes and just couldn't get to them all, but we tried to cover as much as we can, and I think Alan did a great job. Alan, I want to really thank you for being with us tonight. Appreciate you being with us and sharing all your great knowledge tonight with us.
Well, thanks, Roger. I appreciate it, and everybody, I appreciate it. Keep fishing.
Keep fishing, huh? Keeping on. Well, our next broadcast will be on September 6th, 7 p.m. Mountain Time, 9 p.m. Eastern Time. And on that show, I'm going to interview Kevin Erickson, and our topic for the show will be classic salmon flies. Kevin has been tying and exploring the world of classic salmon flies for over 40 years. So tune in to hear a bit of history, tying tips, and the stories behind many of the beautiful feathers that are being used. So if you've ever thought about tying a classic salmon fly, you want to listen into this show and and get jazzed up about it. We'd like to thank the International Federation of Fly Fishers, also Amato Books, Stackpole Books, Whipray Key Fishing Lodge, Watermaster, and Baja Fly Fishing Company for sponsoring our show tonight. Don't forget to visit our website, askaboutflyfishing.com, and make sure you're signed up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Thanks for listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We hope you enjoyed the show. That's it. Good night, everyone, and good fishing.